Joining us on the line now from the UK is Katie Allen. She's with us to talk about her debut novel, Everything Happens for a Reason. Katie used to be a journalist and columnist at The Guardian and Observer and started her career as a Reuters correspondent in Berlin and London. The events in Everything Happens for a Reason are fiction, but the premise is loosely autobiographical. Katie's son, Finn, was stillborn in 2010, and her character's experience of grief and being on maternity leave without a baby is based on her own. And yes, someone did say to her, everything happens for a reason. Oh, Katie, lovely to have you on the book show. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you. It's a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
So I can't believe somebody said to you, everything happens for a reason.
I suppose people try to say the right thing. And I think sometimes, I mean, I think most things that people say when you've lost a loved one or been through something difficult usually come from a good place, or sometimes they come from awkwardness, don't they? I've been in situations where I've sort of said the wrong thing or laughed at the wrong moment, and you just feel awful afterwards because we're not perfect, we're human. But yeah, so our son sadly was stillborn in 2010, so he just basically, the only way I can really describe it is he just stopped living, which was a total shock, obviously. And I, to be honest, didn't really know that could happen. Like I was saying to the doctor, but he's still attached to me, like, you know, just get him out, restart his heart. And so it was an absolute sort of very sudden, shocking experience, quite traumatic. And then I had that awful task of having to tell people what had happened to us, you know, and people are expecting those usual sort of baby cards, photos, you know, nice announcements, updates. And that, you know, you had to sort of say to people, you know, it always started with, I've got some very sad news, I'm afraid. And you sort of apologize to them for sharing this sad news. And one person I didn't know well, it was someone I'd met before, you know, when I was heavily pregnant, and they said, oh, do let me know how you get on. And I thought, you know, sort of playing on my mind, I should, you know, if someone's asked you. So I said, look, you asked me to let you know about the baby. I'm really sorry. I've got some very sad news. He died just before he was born. And she wrote back saying, oh, well, you know, I do believe that everything happens for a reason. And it just really preoccupied me. And I'd like to think that another time in my life, I would just sort of bat it away and be, you know, people say stuff just like I just said to you then, you know, people say things when they're awkward, or they say stuff that's their belief. You don't have to go along with it. But I think I was in such a vulnerable position and in such shock that this sudden thing had happened, that the idea of things happening for a reason was actually quite attractive. Mm. You know, everything making sense again when you've had this nonsensical piece of news given to you.
I guess with that, what happened to you, something so awful and so tragic, it is very difficult for people to know what to say. What can people say other than, oh, my goodness, I'm so sorry?
Yeah, I think so. And I've been asked that quite a bit recently. You know, I've been sort of asked to do press pieces that I hope will be useful. You know, what should one say? And what I would say is don't beat yourself up. You know, I've been through quite a lot of bereavements. I've sadly lost both my parents and a brother and my baby. And I sit there in front of a condolence card and I don't know what to write, because it's just the thing is, you never can say or do the thing the person really wants, right? Which is, all we really want when someone dies is to have that person back. It's a really natural thing about life that we hate death, and, you know, it's very hard to live with, and it just takes time and help from others. But, you know, you can't have the thing you ultimately want. But what I would say is, I think it's always better to say something than say nothing. Mm. You know, I think that was quite painful when there were some people I feel probably knew what had happened to us, but to do it, it got swept under the carpet. And then you sort of think, oh, did his life not matter? You know, he was ready to be born, and he would have been our son and is our son. So I think it's better to, you know, whatever stage or circumstances, I think it's always good for the person who's grieving to know that their grief is acknowledged. Mm. And I think I usually stick, so I'm so very sorry for your loss and deepest sympathies. And I think sometimes it's also okay to say, do you know what, this must be really awful. Yeah. I had a friend say to me the other day, she was talking to a friend whose mum had cancer, and lots of people have said, oh, well, you're lucky they've caught it early, and isn't it good that the NHS do this and this and that? And she said, she just said to her friend, I won't use the words on your radio, so she said, you know, this is really rubbish, isn't it? And her friend said, thank you for saying that. You know, thank you. Don't try and make it smaller. Don't try and make it better. Mm-hmm. Just acknowledge that right now I'm in a really awful situation. It's difficult to know what to say, but I think say something would be my advice. And I think practical help is really good when someone's grieving, and you might get back. You know, people ask me to go out with them in the evenings, and it just made me feel like I was still good company, because I felt awful guilt when our baby died. And I felt, you know, and I did feel that kind of thing. Like I say, I was apologizing to people as I told them the news, because you don't want to bring horrible news into people's lives. You don't want to live in a world where babies die, or, you know, anyone dies, young or at all.
Yeah.
So I felt when people asked me, oh, do you want to come out? Or they take me and my son was two. You know, do you want to come to the park? I thought, oh, God, thank, I'm not toxic. You know, it's an awful thing to say about a grieving mother, but I'm saying that about myself. I thought, oh, maybe I am still good company. And that really helped me rebuild my self-esteem. And I think, you know, there are days when you don't want to do anything. And I think I'd say to friends of people who are grieving, you know, ask again, you know, ask in a few days' time, or say, okay, then, well, let's look again next week if you feel like going to the park.
Mm.
So the isolation of, like, having this grief that, you know, most other people can't comprehend, and nor should they, you know, life does have to go on. It is very isolating, and it's just nice to feel people care.
Yeah. Oh, that's such good advice you give. Absolutely. I totally agree with you about it. It's better to say something than nothing, because obviously people don't know what to say and worry about saying the wrong thing or saying something insensitive. But just to acknowledge it, isn't it? Just to say, I'm so sorry. I'm really thinking of you. Let me know if there's anything I can do, or if you want to go and grab a coffee or whatever. Just reaching out in some way can mean the world, can't it?
Yeah, I think that's the thing to remember, is the isolation of grief. Because I think, you know, you sort of, you're sitting there grieving, and you see people passing by down, you know, I'd look out the window and there are people taking their kids to the park and everyone's laughing. And I don't resent that at all. That's absolutely as it should be. But you need to remember that the person who's grieving, that, you know, for them, life feels very, very strange, and you feel very much sort of on the outside of things. Mm. So sort of just be asked back in, I suppose, is quite nice. And just to be cared about. Yeah, it's lovely. And I had really, and what I need to stress to anybody who I know who picks up my book is, I had very different friends. And I say to my in-laws when I sent them an early copy of the book, I had very, very, the in-laws are not based on you. My friends are not based, because obviously it's fiction, right? So you need a character where bad stuff happens to her, you know, because you need your readers to care and you need the story to have plot. But, you know, I'm always having to stress for everyone, it's not you, it's not you. You weren't like that.
Oh yeah, the thing about isolation and not being left out, again, people would think if they were going out, or especially going to the park where there's other children around, things like that, thinking, oh, we mustn't invite her because that's really insensitive. But as you say, if people ask, then you have the option of saying, oh, thank you, yes, I'd love to, or I'm not really strong enough today, I'm not really feeling it, but, you know, please ask again. But when they just don't ask, then, yeah, as you say, you feel like no one cares or no one wants to be around you.
It's exactly that, isn't it? You don't want to just sort of drop off all the lists. But what I would say to people grieving, which was something I was a bit rubbish at, is you need to have some phrases to hand. I found, and I, you know, this was a friend who said this to me. She said, just use phrases like, you know, sorry, I'm not up to that today. Or say, oh, I'm not feeling so great. Or take a rate, like, I need to take a rain check, which I don't even understand that phrase, but it's really useful because it's really easy to say, or pop in a text, and just, you know, so learn to say no. Because I think sometimes I put myself in situations to sort of prove to myself and other people that I was okay, and I wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
So things that did involve, like, seeing other babies, or just trying to do too much too soon and not acknowledging. I'm a great one for pretending everything's okay and trying to sort of, as my therapist said at the time, trying to go around the grief, not through the grief. I don't know if you know the book, We're Going on a Bear Hunt, but her theory was basically you can't go around it, you can't go over it, under it, you have to go through it, and at some point you're going to have to face it. But I was very good at sort of pretending I could do things.
Mm.
So I think it's good to, as the grieving person, to just be, it's okay to say no.
Yeah.
And then hope that people will ask you again. I'll just say, you know, I'm not up to it today, but, you know, I think next week will probably be better. Should we try next week?
Yeah. Yeah, it's totally okay to say no. I think we say yes too much in life, don't we? Of trying to please other people and, you know, not wanting to upset people and trying to fit in and do everything and not be left out. And it's so liberating saying no.
Yeah, I think when you're grieving, if there's ever a time to say no, or put, I'd say the same, you're a new parent and you've got a precious new tiny new baby, I always say to friends with new babies, it's like, don't invite me over now, like, have these weeks, like, I'll come if you want, but don't feel you have to, you know, share everything with everyone, just have, you know, this precious time. And it's the same when you're grieving, like, have that time. And but also, yeah, so it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because again, you know, if you say no to people, they're going to feel, oh God, should I have asked them? But I think the more open you are and more you say, oh, not today, you know, that doesn't mean I never want to go out again.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So at what point, having gone through this really traumatic experience, so at what point did you think this could make a good book?
Yeah, I don't know. So I went back to work, and I was very lucky in that I fell pregnant again, sort of almost, I think I found out I was pregnant with Ella, who's now just turned 9. Oh. I think on the anniversary of Finn, our little boy's death, found out I was pregnant. So sort of a year between, and then obviously the 9 months of Ella's pregnancy, which were very long 9 months. Poor child, every time she stopped kicking, got sort of poked. And
oh god!
And again, once she was born, poor thing, I didn't get much sleep for the first 6 months, and then I kind of relaxed. So I went back to work at The Guardian, and I think it wasn't that I sort of felt I have to tell this story. Maybe I did, actually. I sort of felt one day I'll write about this, I think. Mm. So I guess as a journalist, your instinct about lots of things is, well, let's write about this. So I went back to work, and I just got to a point where I was like, I just really want to write something longer. I want to write something creative. And I'd bumped into a friend at a wedding, a friend from university who'd done an MA in creative writing. And it was one at City University in London where you do an entire novel. So you know, you have to finish the novel and you have deadlines all the way through. And I thought that really suits me. And I was lucky enough that we were in a position where I could leave my job and do that MA. And that's when I sort of submitted the beginning of what is now this book as my application to the MA. And yeah, the character of Rachel, my main character, she just sort of came to me. I was too early for a press conference near St. James's Park, well, in St. James's Park. I was sort of sitting on a bench. I'm always early for things. I was sort of killing time on this bench. And I was like, I could just see her. It's really sort of this weird moment where I could just see her. She was home alone, should have had a baby with her and didn't. You know, her husband had just gone back to work, and you know, she should have been her first day with her baby on her own, and he wasn't there. And then she started writing to him, and that so she sort of, I think, I suppose it's so the character came to me first. Obviously the character came from my own experience, but it was very much character driven, in that I sort of, Rachel came to me and then her story came together.
So you're saying Rachel wrote to the baby?
Yes, so the whole book is written as emails from Rachel to someone. I won't give away to who. And so I wanted it to be very much a very like sort of strong first person voice of her. Yeah, so you're very much with her feelings. Of course, the danger with that is you kind of get lots of moping and I feel this way, that way. And you don't get enough action. So that was quite a sort of effort to pull off getting some action in, as well as you can't just have her moping. I think not many people would like the book then. and the idea of when I first started thinking about her writing to him, that was I briefly wrote to Finn on exactly that same day. So my son was at nursery, my husband had gone back to work after Finn died. You get paternity leave and maternity leave, I suppose parental leave now. I mean, this was 10 years ago. And yeah, so my husband had gone back. I was sort of home alone, toddler at nursery, and Finn wasn't there. And so I wrote to him, so saying, this is what we'd be doing, which is a really painful thing to do. I'm not sure I would advise that to people. But yeah, that's, I suppose, where she came from and the idea for how to write the book came from. But it wasn't originally written as emails. It was originally, I started the first chunk in third person, then went into first, and then it sort of suddenly hit me. Do you know what? It needs to be her writing emails to someone.
And was writing the book incredibly hard to go through? It must have been very, very emotional for you.
Do you know what? Not as much as I thought. I think sometimes when I read back, so some of the scenes are very true to life. So hospital scenes where she recounts that night where, yeah, that's almost my story entirely. She goes to hospital because he hasn't been kicking much. They do a scan and there's no heartbeat. So that is very much my story. And those scenes are quite painful. But a lot of what happens, you know, Rachel is much bolder than me. She's much braver. So she goes and gets herself into lots of situations in this year that follows the baby's death that I'd like to think I wouldn't be in. She lies quite a lot. Not that much, but quite a lot. So I suppose I think I distanced myself from her. And what I've found much harder is, you know, now with the book coming out, we've been, you know, with my publisher, we've been doing a couple of things for press. Like I said, I've been, you know, I was asked to do a piece about, you know, what to say to people who are mourning the loss of a baby. I found sort of recounting my own experience in those, even though it's 10 years on, I found that much harder. It's really surprised me. Having written the book, I thought, oh, maybe I've dealt with this. God, a therapist would have a field day with me. I thought, oh, yeah, I've dealt with this. Clever me. And then I go to write these pieces over the last few weeks with the book coming out. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I'd go to bed at night and I'm feeling like, you're reliving it. And I just think with the book, I'm just that one step away.
Yeah. And
her sort of busy, crazy life is just sort of, a distraction from those moments that are really painful. Like I said, those moments that are based on what happened to us, I'm trying to remember whether writing them felt painful. Reading them back feels painful. That's the weird thing.
Mm. Yeah, as you say, it brings it all back. I mean, even if you have, it's weird to say got over it. I guess it's mm-hmm. the kind of thing you never really get over, but you learn to live with it.
Yeah.
You move on or whatever, from any death. But then when you're talking about it a lot and talking about the painful moments and the memories, my goodness, I'm sure it must all come flooding back.
I think it's that, like, I don't know. I think, with death, we all go through that denial phase. I know some people, disagree that there are these phases of mourning, but I do think, you have that initial moment of like, no, it's not true. I'm not going to believe that. And then afterwards you don't believe it and you'll wake up and think the person's still alive in the mornings, like, because your brain still hasn't accepted this really sudden, horrible thing.
Yeah.
And I suppose I still have a tiny bit of that now. And I sort of said, did that really happen to us? Like, and it's not, it does get so much easier. And Mike, I don't want to ever speak for other people who've been through a stillbirth. I'll talk about my experience and I'm happy to help, people feel easier to talk about. People talk about breaking the silence around baby loss to make it sort of less taboo. And I think that is easier because, we talked about isolation and you want to be able to tell your story without people flinching and without people running away. But I don't want to speak for other people. But yeah, when I tell our story, I'm just like, really? Did that really happen? Mm. But it does. In my case, it has got a lot easier with time. It has been 10 years and I'm very lucky to have a really happy family. And I'm, of course, really sad that Finn's not part of it. And of course, there'll be moments where I sort of think, oh, he would be this old now. There's always the anniversaries and birthdays and things. Or if I see, if I see two little boys 2 years apart in the park, that would have been, my two sons. So every so often it's sort of catches me, but in my case it's got a lot easier with time.
Mm. Oh, fantastic. And amazingly, through such a poignant story, you managed to bring humor into the book, which I'm incredibly impressed by.
Thank you. I feel like people, you're not allowed to say that your own stuff is funny, it's like laughing at your own jokes. Apparently you're not supposed to put that laughing emoji at the end of your text messages. I read the other day.
Oh dear.
It's like the equivalent of laughing at your own jokes. But I think we do that, don't we? Because you don't want to, like, you just want to be misunderstood in text.
Yes, exactly.
So I'm told it's funny, and I suppose with that, it wasn't intact. I think that's where my MA was really useful, because you read stuff out to a group or you swap work, and I think humour is quite hard. Like I say, you shouldn't laugh at your own jokes, or it's not the done thing. And maybe you don't spot them as well and you don't always intend to be funny. And then other people on the course were like, God, it's really funny. So there's quite a few dogs in there. And I suppose it's quite easy to have, funny stuff in dog scenes, and things go wrong with dogs, don't they? So there's that. Yeah, I think people on the MA were saying she's funny. And I had a couple of people say, oh, should she really be funny at that point in her life? And my argument towards that would be, if she was funny before her baby died, why would she suddenly stop being funny? Or why would she suddenly stop using humour to deal with her pain after her baby died? In fact, you might see more extreme cases of her using her humour. So, and I think I'm like that. I'm sort of slightly in denial sometimes. I sort of slightly try to go around things, make a joke of things, make light of things. So I suppose in that sense, she is a bit like me.
And it's so great to be able to laugh and find humour in sad situations. Otherwise we'd just cry all the time, wouldn't we? I mean, the amount of times that there's been laughter in funerals that I've been to, and
that's
it just
what I was gonna say.
Yeah. And it really makes it, it's fantastic when you're listening to a eulogy or whatever about a person, mm-hmm. and then there's a funny story about something silly that they did, and it makes the day, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah, you always get sort of things, you know, my mum's funeral, we had so many things go wrong, like not on the actual day, but the night before, a sink fell off the wall in her house and flooded the downstairs, and we had a downstairs bathroom, and there was a wasp's nest, and it was summer, so we were having, you know, food outside after the funeral, and there were just wasps on everything. And you can't not laugh in that situation, can you? And I know my mum would have laughed, so... Yeah. Yeah, I think it's about being human, isn't it? And sort of remembering what, you know, those moments we share together when we're laughing. Those are sort of our best moments, I suppose.
Yeah.
And the lows as well. Those are the things that bond us, laughing together, finding the same things funny as someone. So in the book, Rachel comes to know a little girl who's 7. And I think the thing they bond over is they have the same sense of humour. And I think that's a really strong bond if two people have the same sense of humour and find the same things funny and the same things fun to do. Yeah, so hopefully there's some humour in there. And I suppose, like I said, I was really conscious with it sort of being written as emails, which is almost like a diary, isn't it, where she's sort of talking to herself in a way. I didn't want it to be mopey and bleak and, oh, woe is me. You know, yes, she's cross that her baby's died. She's sad her baby's died. But she's also quite determined to unpack this sentence of everything happens for a reason that's told to her very early on by, you know, someone again who means well, that she's so determined to unpack that that she sort of goes on this quest.
Interesting. Well, it's an incredible subject to tackle. I applaud you very much for doing it and doing it with some humour as well. It's been lovely to chat with you, Katie Allen. Thank you for joining us. And if listeners want to get a copy of Everything Happens for a Reason, it's on our website, tre.radio. Thank you, Katie.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. It's lovely to chat to you.